John Stuart Mill wrote in Considerations on Representative Government that a people who had been ruled by despots needed to learn how to be, needed to learn how to become disciplined. A people who had been enslaved needed to learn how to become free. Now, if you've listened to my Negro question recordings, you'll note that Thomas Carlyle represents a particularly significant strain of virulent racism. But he was also one of the most influential characters in 19th century Britain, and his beliefs had great circulation and were often admired and respected. It's not surprising, then, that in the Carlylean tradition we find travellers willing to say some of the more astonishing things I've encountered about colonised people. The first of these is a gentleman named Anthony Trollope, best known for a whole series of novels. Trollope worked for the post office, and he travelled to the West Indies in 1848-49 in order to establish new communication links for the post office in various of the colonies. He also kept a record of what he saw and heard. And it's a fascinating record because Trollope starts out with an ingrained prejudice and does nothing whatsoever to investigate whether or not he ought to have it. Instead, he operates by prejudice and does not even seek to understand the people he's looking at. However, he's also pretty accurate in his descriptions of the colonies and of their political and social condition. So, Trollope is a racist. He doesn't like black people very much. His mother had been an activist for emancipation, but that's neither here nor there. Trollope didn't like black people very much. He thought, though, the people of mixed race were cousins to white people and therefore worthy of some sort of respect. If you ask me, that's even more patronizing than I could deem possible. But Trollope argued that the West Indian colonies, full of black people as they were, required a strict hand to govern them and would be better off as crown colonies rather than as self-governing colonies, which they were at the time. The best-led colony, he argued, was British Guiana, which was a crown colony and where the local upper crust had very little ability to amend or alter the rules. Now, Trollope represents a kind of benchmark, a point at which you can say, all right, we've gone from Carlyle's more or less abstract condemnation of everything with a dark skin to Trollope's specific description of the West Indies as a place that was corrupt and backward. Although the corruption and the backwardness were due not to the black but to the white population. And better government would involve removing parts of the white population from any role in government. So what then? In 1865, there occurred the Morant Bay Rebellion in Jamaica, or the Jamaica Affair, as it came to be called in Britain. The Marant Bay Rebellion in October 1865 involved peasants and landless labourers protesting and demanding assistance during a prolonged drought. Not getting any, they revolted. And their revolt was harshly and savagely put down. And it was the suppression of that revolt that led to a huge division within the English intellectual classes, between those people who supported the right of the colonial governor, Edward John Eyre, to impose harsh discipline on people, versus those who believed that subjects of the crown were entitled to the same treatment regardless of whether they were black people in Jamaica or white people in England. And on the side of those who supported Governor Eyre was a gentleman named Charles Kingsley, who wrote some extraordinary effusions that he should have been ashamed of in his encomium for Eyre. Kingsley went to the West Indies in 1868-69. He travelled to Trinidad via St. Thomas, so we are given a description of black stevedores in St. Thomas who sang hymns on Sundays. And Trinidad, where he spent some time. Now, in Trinidad, he visited all the sort of standard places you'd imagine visiting in Trinidad, the Pitch Lake, the northern coast, the southern extremities. And he also took the time to look at and talk to the people. His conclusions are not very prepossessing. Like Trollope before him, he thought that the West Indians would best be governed by their white betters. Although he met in 1869 J.J. Thomas, who struck him as having a great comic genius, among other things. And J.J. Thomas we will return to later. In 1887, in order to commemorate both the 50th anniversary of Queen Victoria's ascent to the throne and the end of the apprenticeship period and the full abolition of slavery, an Englishman named James Anthony Froude visited the West Indies. Froude was a historian and a journalist and a good friend of Thomas Carlyle's. Indeed, he was Carlyle's first biographer. Froude wanted to see what it was like in the West Indies 50 years after freedom. To put it briefly, to make a long story short, Froude believed that black West Indians needed to be ruled by their white betters. Sometimes making this argument on the basis of a very slight acquaintance with the country. His acquaintance with Haiti consisted of two brief visits, each of 2 hours, and yet he says that from that he can find no way of challenging some of the most slanderous statements made about Haitians by a former British minister to Haiti, who alleged that they salted and ate babies. Froude thought that people he saw in his two brief visits to coastal Haiti, were capable of doing such things as salting babies. Very kind of him, to be sure. And Froude had been appealed to by perhaps the most distinguished West Indian of colour at the time, the Attorney General of Barbados, who had asked him to do what he could to dispel myths about black people. Instead of that, Froude manages to construct several myths along the way, including one in which slavery resulted in Jamaicans having better manners than they might otherwise have had. Now, Carlyle was answered in England. Trollope and Kingsley did not face significant refutations. James Anthony Froude did. And he faced a refutation coming not from a British scholar, but from a West Indian, John Joseph Thomas, J.J. Thomas, who had impressed Charles Kingsley two decades earlier. Thomas took Froude's book on the West Indies, The Bow of Ulysses, or The English in the West Indies, and shredded it in a slim book called Froudacity. And Froude is full of what one might call stock opinions of black people. Thomas is an actual West Indian living in a colony that Froude visited and affected by Froude's recommendations, which included strengthening crown colony rule. Thomas shredded Froude's argument. In particular, he dismissed Froude's argument on grounds of racial inferiority by pointing out that there were black people of great ability who were acknowledged by all white people, such as Frederick Douglass. But Thomas's argument boils down to this. In the West Indies, black West Indians are learning to govern themselves under British tutelage, and it is now about time to expand their role in government in the West Indies rather than keep it constricted. Froude, on the other hand, argued that it should be kept constricted, and Froude's opinions were still influencing thought into the 1920s, which says something about how hidebound British bureaucracy is. So there's J.J. Thomas, and he's saying, we have learned from you, the British, the basics of liberty and of self-government, even though you're not allowing us any real self-government. We should now like to have a greater share in that. We deserve a greater share in that, and people like Froude who say we don't are wrong. Now, this doesn't sound like all that much, but it is the first clear statement of what is called Creole nationalism, the idea that West Indian Creoles, the people who were created by slavery, black, mixed race, and white, should govern themselves on an equal basis, on the grounds that they had received sufficient tutelage from the British so to do. Thomas didn't even want independence. Far from it. All he wanted was a larger share for black Trinidadians in the public life of Trinidad. And unfortunately, he didn't get it. The reforms that were made in the British West Indies in the 1880s extended some political power to some people, but by no means to the people at large. So, the decades tick over, and we come to the Great Depression, when the world was shaken to its foundations by economic failure. In that period, we find the emergence of several different people who were to contribute to the idea of Creole nationalism. The first of these is a gentleman named C.L.R. James. Now, James is best known as a Marxist and a major theoretician in the Trotskyist tradition of Marxism. But that isn't how he started. James's first political work was on politics in Trinidad as it related to British rule. and it was an argument for West Indian independence. Now, the argument that James makes in 1932 is a very straightforward one. You have ruled us. You have taught us. It is now time for you to go and let us take over. We are a people. Indeed, we are a sophisticated people, James is arguing. And we deserve, therefore, to govern ourselves, even though the British imperial might currently prevents that. So here's C.L.R. James, back in 1932, arguing for... When I was a boy, there was a program on British television called Sword of Freedom. It was set in 16th century Florence and was about the adventures and escapades of an artist named Marco del Monte. One of the secondary characters, one who appeared regularly in each episode, was a chap called Niccolò Machiavelli, once rather satirized as Niccolò Macaroni, which is not bad. Machiavelli was a real person. He lived in early 16th century Florence, late 15th century Florence as well. He was a servant of the Florentine Republic. Consequently, when that Republic ended under the rule of the Medici, he found himself tortured because he had been involved in the previous government. This did not, however, discourage him. Machiavelli wrote three political works. One's called The Art of War, Arte della Guerra, and is mostly about the idea that mercenary armies, which were common in Italy at the time, are of no value and should be replaced by citizen levies instead. Now, this is a pretty radical idea, the idea of state conscription or state citizen participation in the military. It was a pretty radical idea at the time. Machiavelli sort of tried it out when he was secretary of Florence, but nothing really panned out. But Machiavelli's better known works are The Prince, Il Principe, and the Discourses on the First 10 Books of Titus Livius, or the Discorsi. Now, The Prince looks like a straightforward, raw explanation of how to get and keep power. But Machiavelli is not interested in power for its own sake. That, he says, may bring honour but no glory. And that is itself a problem. What does Machiavelli want? Machiavelli wants whoever reads the book to act as a prince and reunite Italy. That's what he makes clear at the end of the book. However, to get there, he has to engage in an awful lot of what we call realpolitik. And he cannot be squeamish. This is a sine qua non. So what's there to be squeamish about? Well, you know, dealing with rebellions, dealing with possible rivals. Machiavelli advocates some pretty short courses for that. But is he the monster that many people make him out to be? Is Machiavellian simply a means of saying cruel, twisted, corrupt? And the answer to that is no. Machiavelli wanted Italy unified. Italy at the time was divided into republics, little monarchies, and a large chunk in the centre taken up by the Pope. So it was divided. And Italy came under foreign occupation time and time again, either by armies of German emperors marching south to take over Italy, partly, I suspect, because of the weather, or in the 16th century from the French, who also invaded Italy and played hob with Italian politics. Not to mention, in third place, the Spanish, who created their own kingdom in southern Italy, separate from, but still allied with, Spain. So we have Italy. Three foreign powers seem to be predating on it. Machiavelli says this has to stop. This barbarous dominion stinks to everyone. Those were his actual words. Not as well known as some others in the Prince. So to end this barbarous dominion, you have to rely, says Machiavelli, on cunning, skill, and fortune in order to get what you want. And fortune is particularly important because without it you will not succeed. But you cannot approach it cautiously. You must approach it courageously, openly, and clearly. Although Machiavelli then famously says, fortune is a woman, and it is necessary to beat her and maul her. La fortuna è donna, ed è necessario urtarla e batterla. Me showing off my non-existent Italian. So what's the point? The point is that you have to have a ruler lucky enough to be able to seize on opportunities and skilled enough to use those opportunities in order to reunite Italy. So for Machiavelli, the central concepts of fortune, skill or virtue, though not virtue in a conventional sense, and fortune represent what we might consider to be the three corners of a political triangle. So, what is this about? Well, first of all, Machiavelli wants us to understand that the ruler must have skill. This in Italian is virtù, which leads to translations that aren't quite as accurate as they could be, since he's not interested in a virtuous ruler, or necessarily a particularly strongly moral one, but in an effective ruler. One whose actions count and whose decisions matter. So, we have then this whole idea of virtù, of skill, of effectiveness. And that is combined with what Machiavelli calls occasione, opportunity. You have to have skill, but the skill is of no use unless you have the opportunity to exercise that skill. And it is still of no use unless fortuna, luck, comes in and gives you a thumb on the scale. So in all, a political leader has to be able to manipulate all three. Skill, opportunity, and fortune, in order to be able to unite Italy. And Machiavelli believes that this is possible, that a united Italian nation can rise up out of the congeries of smaller states and the papacy. Machiavelli wrote The Prince at the beginning of the 16th century in 1512. That particular desire of his, a united Italy, did not take place until, in its earliest form, 1860. And in complete form, even slightly more than we have today, in 1919. So 2.5, 3 centuries of waiting, but still, the Italian nation came about. And Machiavelli said that whoever united Italy would be cheered by all, would be gladly received by all, would have none of his desires refused by any. This also turned out to be true, at least in the way in which Garibaldi, the uniter of Italy, was cheered on his arrival in Sicily and then in South Naples before he was preempted by the King of Sardinia in 1860. Be that as it may, Machiavelli is not just about conquest and nation. It's also about something else. The Prince is dedicated to the then ruling Medici in Florence, the real Duke of Florence. And the dedication's quite fulsome. However, the discourses on Livy, was dedicated to two young friends of Machiavelli's. And Machiavelli, in that dedication, deprecated the practice of giving fulsome dedications to prominent people. Is he a hypocrite? No. Is he a realist? Yes. Machiavelli did not believe that much pretense should exist in politics. Rather, he wanted it to be clear and direct. You want government, you need government, you have government, it has a cost. But part of that cost is simply the maintenance of government itself, and part of it is the cost of having political conflict that can escalate into actual war, civil or international. And Machiavelli is less concerned with that than he is with class warfare, as it turns out. Because the discourses are not about a prince. They're not about creating a single unified state under a single unifying ruler. They're about states governed by their own people, republics. For Machiavelli is not a monarchist. He's a republican, with a small r, please. He wants Italy to be united not under a king or under the pope, but as an Italian republic in which the Italian middle classes would take the dominant role. Now, this is actually a very radical position. It is not the how to be a dictator version of Machiavelli that we get most of the time. It is rather a considered, deep, and philosophically founded belief. And Machiavelli has a philosophical foundation for his state. State, by the way, is a word that Machiavelli coined. And that is to say, there is a conflict within the state that keeps it alert and alive. And that conflict is between the wealthy and the poor, or the many. The wealthy want to grab everything that isn't nailed down and a lot of stuff that is nailed down for themselves. They are greedy. The common people want to be left alone to pursue their lives. The tension between these two interests is maintained and maintains the republic. Since a republic has to have popular support in order to be a republic, and it cannot simply be an oligarchic state ruled by the rich. Although Venice was very much that at the time. So Machiavelli wants a republican government, and his model republic is the ancient Roman Republic, which is why his book on republics is a discourse on the first 10 books of Livy's History of Rome. And his argument is a pretty straightforward one. A republic is more lively, healthier for the citizens, and more stable in the long run. Machiavelli worries about decay and degeneration. And what he argues is that a republic founded on the idea that classes had different interests would be the best form of government. Now, Machiavelli actually says some more, because there's one point in which he praises an organization called the Feimgericht, which existed in parts of Germany and Switzerland at the time, which in his words, would destroy any nobles that they came across. Now, the Feimgericht wasn't exactly that, but it was certainly popularly based. And Machiavelli's radicalism with regard to the nobility, to the wealthy ruling class, had no equal before Marx. For Machiavelli wants a middle-class Italy, run by middle-class Italians. So in that sense, you could say Machiavelli is Aristotelian. But his vision of the state, his vision of the good state, is one in which all Italians will become one people, will exist as one people. And what's so bad about that? The answer to that is nothing. Machiavelli has a terrible reputation, largely because, A, he was coldly practical about the nature of power, and B, because he was a republican, because he opposed monarchy and wanted Italy to be united as a republic. Those two things got him on the index of forbidden books by the Catholic Church. And technically, I think, it is still wrong for Catholics to read Machiavelli. I did know this, and I assigned Machiavelli to my undergraduates nonetheless. This is something you have to know if you want to understand anything about the history of political thought. So Machiavelli gives us these ideas. He gives us the idea of a united nation brought together by a founder, and a united nation where this made up not of ruler and subject, but of citizens. And this is a powerful idea. It is an idea whose time has definitely come and come and come.